This podcast exists because of our supporters at DecodingTV.com. Head over to DecodingTV.com to sign up to receive ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus episodes that Kim Renfro and I will record just for members. Thanks to everyone who makes this podcast possible.
My princess, ours is a bond that has long endured. Since Lucas Blackwood, the grandsire of my grandsire, aided the dragon in his war of conquest.
Aye, the Blackwoods truly turned the tide on that one.
Caused with the blood of the first men, our history is deeply rooted in this land, which your house has made its home. If chosen as your match, princess, your day shall be easy and night safe under my protection.
Protection? The princess has a dragon, you dumb cunt.
That guy's a real joker. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV recap podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen, and I haven't read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon's based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Every week on the show, we discuss, we recap, we spoil everything through this week's episode of House of the Dragon. But we do not spoil anything from future week's episodes. That includes anything on the next time on preview. That includes anything that might be in the books. This week, we'll be discussing Season 1, Episode 4 of House of the Dragon, entitled King of the Narrow Sea. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com and email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Support the podcast at decodingtv.com. Kim Renfro, you know, the number one complaint we get about this podcast, too perfect. not enough errors on the podcast. And so every now and then we like to spice things up a bit, throw in an error every now and then just to keep people on their toes.
That's exactly what I do.
And that is, in fact, something that happened last week on the show. We made a quote-unquote factual error about dragon riders in the show. Kim, you want to explain what happened?
Yes, for shame. You can go ahead and shame bell me. Yes, I inaccurately said that the reason why Laenor, who is the son of Corlys Velaryon, is a dragon rider and his dragon is Seasmoke. I said that was because, oh, they're like all from the blood of old Valyria, something to that effect. What I meant was that Laenor Velaryon is a dragon rider, not because of his Velaryon blood, but because his mother is Rhaenys Targaryen. So he has Targaryen blood that enables him to be a dragon rider. Only those of Targaryen blood descent can be dragon riders within this universe.
Indeed. So thanks to everyone who sent that correction in and
keeping me on my toes.
Yes, keeping Kim on her toes and making sure we're staying accurate to the world of the books. So appreciate people who gave us that correction. But it is true. On occasion, we may make a mistake or two. We'll try to correct it here on the show. I do want to say that people can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com, and we'll be addressing people's emails on the Decoding TV bonus episodes. So especially if you're a member, you can comment at decodingtv.com or email us at acastofkings@gmail.com, and we'll be doing bonus episodes that talk about mailbag things, so feel free to send us your mailbag questions. We did get quite a bit of emails about the topic of incest on the show, and I thought we should just have a conversation about it right up top before we even get to the episode, because I think it's very important to the episode. It's like we've gotten a lot of emails already, like literally in the last 12 hours since the episode aired, we've gotten several emails from people being like, I don't understand how incest works in the show, specifically what people's attitudes are towards it. Because on the one hand, we know that the Targaryens seem to have normalized it. On the other hand, Viserys seems to be really against it or have opposition to it. People did write in and tweet at me about my objection to King Viserys's attitudes about incest last week episode, where he was saying it doesn't make sense for Rhaenyra to be wed to his son because he's only 2 years old. And a lot of people took that as less an objection to incest and more an objection to the fact that he's so young and therefore there'd be many childbearing years that would be wasted with Rhaenyra being married to a child.
Right. Like if the goal is to shore up the line of succession, her marrying her like 2-year-old half brother isn't going to fix that problem anytime soon.
I mean, I still think the way that he's approaching, King Viserys is approaching it, feels a little bit naive to me. There's no like, okay, hey, good idea. Like, you know, there's no like, hey, Otto, I like where your head's at, but like, I'm going to yes and you. You know, there's nothing, there's none
no
of that.
No bad
right?
ideas in the brainstorm.
We're all brainstorming here, right? There's nothing like that. He's just like, ew, you know, he's just like reacting. So I still kind of have an issue with that. All that said, okay, Kim, as far as we can understand, what are the attitudes towards incest in Westeros? And what are the attitudes towards incest in House Targaryen in the show?
Yeah, so an important like starting point of information to include is that George R. R. Martin, author of Fire and Blood, the whole world of Ice and Fire, Song of Ice and Fire, he has said that Targaryens often wed within like their immediate family, either brother to sister. He specifically brings up aunt and nephew as an example, like wink, wink. Jon Snow and Daenerys at some point. Like that was like a big reason why people believed that they were definitely going to hook up, was because George had kind of been like, oh yeah, aunts and nephews of Targaryens, which also means uncles and niece, whatever. But the point is that Targaryens often marry within their own family to retain the strongest possible bloodline of dragon riders, especially after the Doom of Valyria, which basically eradicated the world of all other dragon riding families. And so they have this like deep tradition and custom to, whenever necessary, or I guess whenever somebody wants to within the family, it's like totally cool among them to have incest happening. The rub comes when they arrive to Westeros, and Westeros, prior to Aegon the Conqueror's arrival and his sister wives, remember he married both, not one sister, he married both of his sisters, and they conquered Westeros. Westeros followed the Faith of the Seven, which is its own religion. It's not a religion that the Targaryens were born practicing. It didn't come from Valyria. This is of Westeros. But basically, like, if you think about it as like the Pope, if like the High Septon is the Pope, it's like the Pope eventually made an amendment to the Faith of the Seven's rules, which are against incest, and said, well, it's okay if it's Targaryens because they are different. It's almost like they decided to treat them as like their own race of people who are some, it's like Targaryen exceptionalism. They are the exception to the rule under the Faith of the Seven that incest is not okay. So that's where you get sort of like this like confusing attitude towards it from some people. Because again, if we're using like the Pope example, it's as if like, you don't agree with the fact that this exception was made for Targaryens. Like it still is like a little bit gross to people who follow the Faith of the Seven and therefore have been raised with the understanding that you can only ever marry like a first cousin if necessary. Beyond that, it's a big no-no. And so there is like, there's a bit of conflict within it, right? Of like people who follow the faith, I guess understanding that Targaryens have their own exception to this rule, but still maybe being very uncomfortable with the idea and finding it offensive, depending yeah. on the situation. From within the family, which maybe...
Basically, like, Westeros is not really in favor of incest. Like, it doesn't happen all the time in Westeros culture or anything like that.
No.
They are aware that Targaryens sometimes have incest within their to preserve royal bloodlines, and they more or less like understand it happens and like kind of accept it, but it's like it's good for them but not for me kind of deal
and part of this right? also comes from like a history of conflict between like after Aegon the Conqueror's reign. So once we got into like more kings, there was sometimes conflict between new Targaryen kings and Faith of the Seven representatives or septons and everything, and sometimes that led to like actual bloody wars among like the Faith of the Seven. Faith Militant is like a thing. Remember that happened in Game of Thrones. That had happened prior in the past too. And so it's almost like this this agree to disagree thing came about as like a way to keep peace effectively. Mm-hmm. But there are still some people who feel the need to like be outwardly disgusted by incest,
sure.
even though it's something that the faith has like
some people just feel the need out of nowhere to be outwardly disgusted by it. You know, who's to say where it comes? Who's to say what political motivations it has? okay. So then within the Targaryen family, right? Uh-huh. Apparently there are still divergent attitudes as we see with King Viserys, but I'm curious, like it seems as though it is largely accepted within the Targaryen family.
Yeah, and I would say that the times where you might see objection to it from within the Targaryen family is possibly coming from the knowledge that, like, wedding brother to sister or wedding, like, father to daughter, I actually don't know if that ever happened, that they worry that that will, like, that will incite another conflict between the faith. So I think sometimes it's like, okay, when can we, like, curb this thing that we know is controversial to everybody else in the realm so as not to disturb, like, the hard-fought peace that we have going on at the moment.
Interesting. I think very little of that is made super clear in the show.
Oh, totally.
And who knows if they're going to change it for the show, but that is really good context to have heading into an episode like this one. Mm-hmm. So any other thoughts on incest before we move on to the rest of the stuff on incest we're going to cover this episode, Kim?
I think we can save the rest for our more detailed chat in a few minutes.
Let's dive into season one, episode four of House of the Dragon, King of the Narrow Seas. Let's start with overall thoughts on this episode, Kim Renfro. What did you think?
I really loved it. I think that this was another really good example of how the stories set in this world in both Game of Thrones and now House of the Dragon can really excel when it's like a character drama and when you just understand everybody's motivations, everybody's wants and needs, and how those are in conflict with one another throughout the whole episode. Yeah, I thought it was really great. What'd you think?
Same. This episode was awesome. It had a lot of interesting thematic elements to it. Awesome performances. It's one of those episodes that you're like, hey, I want to talk about. It's honestly an episode like this. That's why this podcast exists. Mm-hmm. Is so we can talk about it. Because everyone, it's like one of those buzzy episodes that it's like, wow, so much happened. Let's all talk about it. And
yeah,
so
covered so much ground right. in an hour.
I really loved it. I thought it was a great episode. And I think the show is really finally starting to come into its own. I do think that it's not a coincidence that there is the smallest time jump between episodes, basically between last episode and this episode. And that allows for things like character development we can feel and understand, you know, like actions that seem directly connected to what we just saw from the previous episode, which you don't get when you have a 3-year time jump. You know, it's not really as possible. So I don't think it's a coincidence that it's like, there is a time jump. It's like months, right, since last episode, but not huge.
Yeah, I would guess maybe around 6 months max. Yeah. I can't tell. Someone else who knows what babies look like in the immediate months after their birth, tell me. Because it looks like to me like that baby's not like fresh, but it's also not like 1 year old.
So I think it's complicated. First of all, Allison looked like she was in her third trimester last episode.
Oh, yeah. Like right? about to give birth any day.
The problem is there is a floor on how young babies can be in shows, right?
True.
Because the actors are not actually having the babies, so they're actually recruiting actor babies from other people.
Way to spoil TV magic, David Chen. You're telling me this actress didn't get
right. pregnant. And so usually, like, when a character has a baby, they pull a baby out from under the whatever. It's from under the medical sheet. I'm not saying anything about body parts. The baby is like at least weeks old, if not months old. Usually right. the baby they pull out, right?
Right.
Because it's like,
or it's CGI, or like some
or
horrifying.
It's animatronic, you know. So anyway,
yeah.
So basically, I don't trust baby ages.
Okay, right.
In TV shows and films is what I'm trying to say.
This baby actor cannot be relied upon for our timeline. But yes, I would say it's been about.
Dare you suggest it might be relied upon, Kim Renfro? Anyway.
Terrible performance from this baby actor.
So the episode begins in Storm's End. Where is Storm's End, Kim Renfro?
Storm's End is not too far away from King's Landing, but Storm's End is the region of Westeros. It's the castle in the region of Westeros where House Baratheon resides. Mm. And so it's almost like on this tour of trying to find suitors, Rhaenyra has wound up being hosted by the Baratheons in order to have all the nearby eligible bachelors come and vie for her hand.
Yeah. And as you pointed out in our Twitter space that we do every Sunday night on Twitter, be sure to follow us both if you want to get those spaces. There's a lot of Aladdin energy in this episode.
Yes, right? Totally.
Rhaenyra has a lot of Princess Jasmine energy in the episode. But yeah, she's looking at a long line of suitors and she's like, this guy's too old. And then this young, adorable, oh, by the way, the older guy is a Dondarrion. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe she's a Dondarrion, which is kind of funny if like Kristen Cole sitting there watching her. We've talked in the past about how Kristen Cole was knighted by a Dondarrion. So I don't know if this is supposed to be the exact same one, but it is interesting that they like brought the Dondarrions back in for this little spat. But yeah, then
adorable child comes forward with a lovely speech about how he's going to take care of her and everything. There was some debate online about who this child is, because some people speculated that he might be Benjicott Blackwood, but some others said that it might not be Benjicott Blackwood because of the age and because of what point in the timeline we're in. As of this morning, there is confirmation of who the child is, right?
Yeah.
Who is this child?
Reporter Liz Shannon Miller, I guess, asked HBO directly to confirm like the character name, which was super smart. So apparently his name is Willem Blackwood, which as far as I know, that is not a name that was in any of the books. So I think that the show has sort of made him like an amalgamation of different Blackwoods. But in Fire and Blood, basically this whole scene comes from just like one short sentence in Fire and Blood, which says, when Rhaenyra visited the Trident in 112 AC, the sons of Lord Bracken and Lord Blackwood fought a duel over her. And so the younger guy is the son of Lord Blackwood, or now we know Willem Blackwood. And the older kind of like teenage, maybe early 20s frat boy looking Westerosi lord is the son of Lord Bracken. And in the books, actually, Lord Bracken wins that duel, we find out eventually. Mm-hmm. However, the show, again, like made this little tweak and had Lord Blackwood come out victorious. But yeah, I loved that. I loved this moment, not only for the way that it adapted from the book. I think it's a really good example of like he's sort of there as the stand-in for loss of innocence among young men. It's like if this whole episode is about Rhaenyra and Alicent having to contend with like being pushed into womanhood or whatever, this seems to be the first time that little Lord Blackwood has killed anybody. You can sort of see him like about to vomit in the background.
I know. You see him about to throw up and I was like, oh, I wish we'd seen what happened, because that's such a, it's an amazing moment, to like a character moment, that he clearly like got out over his skis killing this guy, and then he wasn't prepared for it emotionally or physically for it. And
yeah,
and he looks like he's about to vomit. You don't see it; it cuts away. But to me, this scene gave me vibes of season one, King Joffrey, House of Game of Thrones. I don't know if you remember, there was like a guy who was singing this song. And he's like, okay, do you want me to, like, you sang a song that was offensive to me. Do you want me to cut off your hands or your tongue? And then like, he's like, well, I guess I need my hands to work, so it's going to be tongue. And then like, there's a camera shot where you're like walking, you're pulling away from him while like this incredibly violent act is occurring out focus in the background.
Yeah.
I think the framing is almost like identical. I didn't go back and check, but like, it's a thing of like, extreme violence is normalized in this society, I think, right? Like when they're breaking out in this duel, it's not like Sir Kristen's like, oh, let's get you out of here, like the Secret Service with the president or so. It's like, oh, we're just like walking away because this is just something that I guess happens a lot. So anyway, I thought it was a nice touch to show like, oh yeah, I guess people did used to duel each other and like disembowel each other,
Yeah.
In Westeros back then, you know?
I mean, and part of me thinks, I mean, it's also not, it seems to me to be related also to what we've talked about, like the violence that we saw in the tourney, right? Which is like, logically, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for these younger lords to be like murdering each other's sons. But I think that what these first four episodes are doing are taking us from peacetime, everything's fine in the realm, to like everything's getting more and more splintered, a little bit more factious. And so like, this is just one more example that we see of this like random bloody violent outburst among young lords who have never encountered war before, right? I also just love the detail of like the production design here with like the leaves kind of like all over the floor blowing around. It gives you fall impressions. And as we know, like in Westeros, seasons are unpredictable, but like the change from something like summer into fall would be pretty significant for what that means for the realm and sort of like shoring up now for whenever winter is going to come.
Indeed. She then sails back to King's Landing and sees Daemon's dragon fly overhead. She almost gets hurt by it, but she's also kind of in awe of it. Like she likes Daemon. She's looking forward to his return. Before we move on to what happens next, any other thoughts on this whole sequence of events?
You totally nailed, or you brought up again, the Jasmine and Aladdin vibes, which is just like Rhaenyra clearly like wanting to find a suitor that she's excited by. And I don't think it's a coincidence that like she exits this scene, which is clearly like a bunch of duds in line. And then she gets all like, ooh, like starry eyed when she knows that Daemon is coming back to King's Landing.
Indeed. All right, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors. We'll be right back with more conversation about House of the Dragon. It's time to thank one of our sponsors this week, Manscaped. Brace yourselves, folks. Winter is coming. And what the writers of House of the Dragon didn't want to tell you is that the reason that King Viserys is so ineffectual is because he didn't trim his balls with Manscaped. Poor guy thought it was okay to trim his balls with a traditional razor or hair trimmer. Don't pull a King Viserys. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code CASTOFKINGS at manscaped.com. I actually personally love manscaped.com's products. I don't know if you guys have used traditional razors to try to do some grooming, but they are not designed for the more sensitive areas of your body. And so manscaped.com has solved this with their awesome technology and design. The new Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer is waterproofed with advanced skin-safe technology to reduce nicks and cuts, and even has a light to help you with your close shave down there. They also sell the Weed Whacker, an ear and nose hair trimmer, which can help you whack those nasty weeds in your delicate holes. This product also has proprietary skin-safe technology to help prevent nicks, snags, and tugs. But maybe you're on the other side of the wall. You don't know when your next shower is. The Crop Mop Ball Wipes can help you out there. And for when you're done with grooming and you want to just smell good, the Refined Cologne by Manscaped is a clean and fresh scent designed for the refined gentleman. On top of that, they have a great carrying case for all this stuff, the Shed Travel Bag to carry your goods, and the Manscaped Anti-Chafing Boxer Briefs to hold the entire package together. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code CASTOFKINGS at manscaped.com. During the winter, you may be spending more time inside with your balls. Might as well make them beautiful. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code CASTOFKINGS at Manscaped. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code CASTOFKINGS. Be sure to join the Manscaped movement. These products are no joke. So Rhaenyra returns to King's Landing, and there is a throne room scene, I feel like, where Viserys and Daemon have a confrontation. And we get the sense that this is, again, fairly somewhat shortly after the events that we saw last episode, where Daemon wins this war in the Stepstones, right? Mm-hmm. Or this battle, this series of battles in the Stepstones. And drop some mean stats about the people that have been left behind to warn others away.
2,000, right?
Yeah, 2,000 that were like, it sounds like they were like...
I think that he hammered them to a stake in the same way that Crabfeeder had, but just like, I imagine like a row of slowly dying people across like a low tide bay, basically, which is a pretty gnarly visual.
Yeah, it must have taken a lot of work to hammer those 2,000 people in, is all I could think about. Like, wow, he must be exhausted. when Daemon comes into the throne room, I just love that scene, you know, when he walks straight up to the king and one of the guards like puts a sword up to his chest and he like walks right into it. That scene is in the trailer, and I just think it's like such a badass like power move to be like, yeah, go ahead, you know, try me and see what happens. Like, and so I love that. Everything about the scene was pretty awesome. The idea of like, there's all this drama about whether Daemon's going to actually respect King Viserys at all. He does bend the knee. He does like give up his crown. It's very like actually moving, you know, because you never see these characters really get along. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, another reason why I wish there hadn't been such massive time jumps is like, we would have gotten to see, it would have meant even more. It was already powerful. It would have meant even more if we saw a little bit more of their relationship develop in the past. And then of course you see Rhaenyra shooting all these interesting looks at Daemon, because here's the thing. Daemon is one of the most effective people in the show. He's one of the most action, proactive, action-oriented, get things done people in the show. Whatever his weaknesses are, he at least knows how to get stuff done. And as Rhaenyra is one of those people as well, or she wants to be one of those people, like you can see why there'd be such admiration there. So yeah. A lot of great dynamics going on in this scene. Anything else you wanted to mention, Kim?
I just love the added tension of the fact that like she's not supposed to be there. Like as far as King Viserys knows, she still has like 2 months left of this tour. So the idea that like the three of them in that room are engaged in this like little dance thing, right? Where like Rhaenyra doesn't really want her dad to see. So she hides out in the back, but then she's trying to catch Daemon's eye and he just walks right past her. So then she follows Daemon all the way up to the front of the room. And I think it's just like, I thought it totally nailed that dynamic of like younger teen person who's like, oh, like my cool uncle's back. He always like gives me presents. Or like this is a guy who understands me in a way that my father doesn't always seem to. And like, I just thought that was really beautifully staged and directed.
There's a celebration in this little courtyard with the Godswood. And you notice this detail about the snack table, right, Kim?
She loves lemon cakes. Just like Sansa. Yeah, like they open with her taking just the lemon off the top of a lemon cake and eating it, which I think is like also an interesting bit. Like her taking the most like tart and like concentrated flavor of lemon. She's like, I don't need the whole cake. I'm just going to eat the lemons. And when I screenshotted it, I saw that there's like 8 cakes that all don't have lemons on top of them. So I'm like, has she just been sitting over here eating slices of lemon sugar bit by bit?
You ever watch Seinfeld?
Occasionally, but not like all the way through.
There is an episode where they tried to open a restaurant that only served the tops of muffins because the top of the muffin's the best part, right?
Right.
And it was called Top of the Muffin to You, and it was gonna be awesome, you know. So I think Westeros needs a top of the lemon cake to you restaurant is kind of what I'm gathering from this scene.
Isn't that just like candied lemon peels?
I don't really know how lemon cakes work, Kim. So you tell me.
I'll bake some for you. But yes, I love that detail. Also, that's such a like teenager at the family party move of like lingering by the snack table a little bit to put off the time that you like have to go do the chit chat.
Yeah, yeah. So there is chit chat. There's some conversation between Alicent and Rhaenyra about what their place in life is. You know, Alicent's like, hey, your dad really did a lot of work to try to make this suitor thing work for you. You're kind of just pissing all over it. And, you know, you might have mentioned this last night or someone else mentioned, but it's like they kind of like, in some ways, like want to swap places. Not like Rhaenyra wants to sleep with her dad, but like like Alicent would love to be kind of in her situation where she gets to choose who she's with.
Mm-hmm.
And Rhaenyra would probably love to be more respected as a queen.
Totally.
Although she'd want to be like the ruler and not just queen to Viserys' king.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think it's also... Go ahead.
Go ahead. You go.
I was going to say, it's also one... A specific moment that I love in this right before Rhaenyra and Alicent are like kind of having a chummy moment again, like we're seeing them sort of feel like they're friends, is when there's like an awkward silence between the group and Alicent tries to fill that in by being like, oh, perhaps we can take Daemon to see the tapestries. And like the way that Viserys and Daemon just like laugh in her face about that and have this sort of like brotherly moment of like, oh, like silly little queen, like thinking that we want like those formalities, I think is also like, it's an important moment for us to see the way that Alicent is treated like among the court and in front of Viserys. And I think that she would gladly trade that to be Rhaenyra, who from her point of view has a little bit more freedom and can be like assertive and be listened to in that space.
Yeah. Daemon and Rhaenyra have a chat about things and about what the meaning of marriage is in this world. But I think it's Daemon that says marriage is only a political arrangement, end quote. And that's kind of one of the key elements that drives this whole episode. And one of the ways in which a show like this can be a great show is by illustrating harsh truths about this fantasy world that theoretically is based off of our medieval ages, it can help us to understand how we got to where we are in present day society, right? In some ways. And the idea of marriage being a political arrangement is a potent one. But mm-hmm. anything you want to mention about this conversation they have?
I just, once again, I think that the writers are doing something really smart with Damon, in that, like, he's a bad dude. Like, we've seen that he makes violent and harsh and cruel decisions sometimes, but he also seems to be the one who frequently says the truth about a situation. And I think that that's just, again, like, a great consistency to have, like, one of your quote unquote, like, worst characters also sometimes being the most honest and observant about the world around them. And he does it again when he, like, tells Rhaenyra that what happened to her mother was a tragedy, but, like, the world is just tragic. And if you live in fear, then you're going to miss out on, like, the actual good parts of life, which is, like, I can't really argue with that, Damon, even though you sort of suck. Also, another small moment in this is, like, the way that he offers the wine glass to her. It's just, like, one more example of the way that he seems very aware of, like, his power over her, or, like, his authority in any sort of situation. And it's, like, he's trying to, like, make them feel like peers by being like, oh yeah, here, have, like, a sip of my wine. Like, we're just chit-chatting. We're speaking in High Valyrian. We have, like, our own little bond. And then, as we see later in the episode, he knows how to, like, push that further and further.
Yeah, kind of this way of understanding what she is looking for, which is just to be treated like one of the adults. That's really what mm-hmm. she wants, right? And she wants autonomy, and she wants the rights that any male would have in her situation, right, is what she's looking for. And I think he understands that, and he wants to talk to her in that way. There is some conversation at the small council about Corlys Velaryon, who's didn't show up, notably, to this whole meet and greet. And they clearly have some tension because King Viserys rejected his offer to for him to wed his daughter. And they're going to have to figure out a way to get through that, obviously. And they're like, well, hey, we need another marriage unification to another sort of pact to help us get through the situation. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I wonder who the pact might be between.
Truly. But I do at least appreciate that Rhaenyra is sitting at the table now, which is a marked change.
She's no longer
change.
Serving the drinks. That's great.
Right. Everyone still looks at her awkwardly, but at least it's awkwardly as she's seated there, not like holding a pitcher of wine in the background while everyone's talking about her.
We get a couple glimpses of Alicent in this episode. And I think, like, at this point, we can now kind of talk about the three different sex scenes that we have mm-hmm. in this episode, right? Like, because they all kind of progress from this point.
Yes.
And each scene has different characters in it. Each scene has a different power dynamic and means something different to each of the characters in a really interesting way. Let's start with Alicent, because we meet Alicent. She's not pregnant anymore, so she had the child, and you see the baby, and apparently it's a girl, right? Is that right?
Yeah, so this is her second child. It's a girl named Helena. They didn't specify this in the episode.
That's not called in the episode, though, right?
No.
Yeah.
I just know that.
And then Alicent, at a later point, goes to sleep. There's a knock on the door, and it's like the king has requested your presence. It's like they sleep apart most of the time, is what it seems like. Not enough room in the king's bedroom with all that Valyrian model taking up all that space.
No.
Like, and the thing is there after years, right? Like, it feels like it's got to be impractical. Like, do you know what I mean? At some point, the king's going to be like, hey, this thing is in the way when I get up and want to go to the bathroom or, like, leave the room. I don't know why he leaves that thing in there, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
Put it on display in the throne room, you know, like,
well,
people,
but, like, now it's too big to get out the door. It's like when you build an IKEA couch inside of your room and then you can never take that couch outside again.
It's so true. Yeah. Anyway, we should also point out there's another scene where, like, I guess you see, and in the sex scene, you see more of the king's decaying body, and, like, Alicent, like, kind of is, like, cleaning his wounds, I guess, his open sores. And so you get a sense that she is, like, there is some care there. There is some concern. Like, it's not, like, completely, like, she has no affection for him at all. But clearly is not, like, happy with the arrangement and can't voice that. That's my sense of it.
Yeah, I mean, Allison, throughout this whole episode, we get the sense that she is like very committed to doing her duty as the queen of this realm. And she knows what that means, which is like supporting her husband, preserving his dignity. Like that's almost what I read when she like sends the servants out, is like she can see his discomfort at being seen so like exposed. And she just decides like, I'll just take it from here. And like, he interprets that as like, oh, she loves me so much. Whereas like, I interpreted that as like, no, she just like, she's an empathetic person and she wanted to make you feel better in that moment, which is a very sweet, wholesome thing to do. And his response to that is, great, I'm going to wake you up in the middle of the night and summon you to my room so that you can like lay on my bed uncomfortable while I have sex with you. Gross.
Yeah. Like, pretty uncomfortable. And also like his body is like continuing to decay. Like during the sex scene, you see like all these sort of open sores all over his body. So my sense is he is not heading towards a peaceful, painless death just based on, you know, how he's physically doing.
Yeah.
But it does kind of vividly illustrate the life that Alicent has been living for all this time, which is, you know, she, as a loyal servant to the king, needs to do things that are really not enjoyable to her and shouldn't be expected of anyone, you know?
Right.
So.
Yeah. And that, like the contrast, like the fact that we see her like holding her crying baby and Rhaenyra just like walks right past the room. Like you can hear this baby crying, but like, she's not going to help Alicent with this baby. Like she gets to go off and do her own adventure, Jasmine out of the castle in disguise, like Gambit, whereas Alicent is like entirely like chained to that castle in that room where babies are crying and she's having deeply uncomfortable sex and like just seems really sad. I really feel for Alicent throughout this whole episode.
Yeah. So Rhaenyra goes back to her room. And I want to point out that she has great rapport with Sir Criston Cole this whole time. It's like, oh, those two should really be together, you know? That would be the greatest outcome, is if she wound up with Sir Criston Cole. I mean, sure, he is sworn to celibacy as a member of, what is it?
The Kingsguard.
Yeah, so he's not supposed to. And it would be a massive scandal if a woman of Rhaenyra's position wed someone from the Kingsguard. Probably would be really bad for the kingdom overall, because it would, you know, just upend a lot of norms and people would be upset about it. There'd be unrest, but that's what should happen. You know, that's the outcome that we all want.
That's anyway. He's, I think, in this episode, a really good, like almost Prince Charming character, right? Like he's the shiny white, always very deferential to her. He's very protective of her, constantly like making sure that she's okay. And it's like, yeah, no duh. Like 18-year-old Rhaenyra is going to be like, hey, I kind of like this one.
yeah. I mean, he understands her even more than Daemon does, arguably. Probably because they spend a lot more time together, but anyway.
True.
So she gets a bag with some clothes and a message that we later learn is from Daemon. With instructions to sneak out through this passageway. We see that massive dragon skull that we saw in, I think, episode one. Where she sneaks past it and she's dressed like a commoner. And they basically go out on these adventures in King's Landing. They go to see King's Landing. It's like, I guess it's a it's like a night fair going on at King's Landing. Do you think this is like a special event, Kim Renfro, or is it this is what King's Landing is like every night? Literally, it's the culture is that rich.
I think this is what King's Landing is like most nights, or at least certain neighborhoods of King's Landing, right? Like they specifically
say like the Times Square of King's Landing, basically.
It really is, yeah. You can see a show and then see another show of a different ilk. Drink a little bit, you know, run amok.
Yeah. And I have to say, I really enjoyed all the details of everything that was going on in King's Landing. Like these frames are really dense. There's like somebody walking a tightrope and there's someone else who looks like they're passed out and getting robbed and someone's eating fire and like all this stuff is happening like all around them in ways that make it feel like really, you know, you can imagine as somebody who spends all their days in the castle, like going out, it would be like sensory overload to watch all this stuff happen. But I really loved all the detail of that entire sequence. So anything else you want to mention about King's Landing before we get to the scene? I mean, there is a scene where they go watch a little play with puppets and actors dressed up, and Rhaenyra sees who, you know, what the city folk really think of her. It's pretty hilarious when she tries to like rousing the crowd in the opposite direction. Yeah, she's like, boo.
Yeah. She's like, slander. Yeah. Slander. That's, it's libel if it's in writing.
I
love that.
Which is like pretty hilarious. Yeah. But
the only other detail I would add real fast is that I love that the secret passageway that Daemon shows her, all of those secret passageways were built by a previous king, Maegor the Cruel, who we've heard Daemon compared to in the past. And Maegor specifically, like, had all of the builders create these like secret tunnels, passageways, fake doors, and then killed every single person who worked on the project. So that's why like she seems so excited and thrilled to hear about this, because it's like being let in on like a deep family secret, basically.
Also, we already kind of know what the people who are being ruled would think of the fact that Rhaenyra might be heir to the throne. It's been made clear to us in a number of different ways. What hasn't been made clear is her learning what they actually think through unassailable sources, which is like actually being amongst them, right? Like,
totally.
This is like a big, but it doesn't really seem like a wake up call. She's not like, whoa, like, look at these, these people don't respect me. She doesn't have that realization yet. Maybe she will later, because she's like, it doesn't matter what they think. It's going to be fine, you know, like. And so I do wonder, like, how long her education will be on this topic and how it's all going to play out. Because I don't know how it's going to play out, because I haven't read the books. But we'll see.
We will see.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more discussion of House of the Dragon. So then Daemon takes her to a pleasure house. And the way in which this whole sequence is shot is, like, pretty cool. It's like very dark, like very moody atmospheric lighting, and the editing gets slow and weird. Last night at the Twitter space, I commented on how like some of the editing with him and her got a little weird. I don't know if you caught it, but basically like sometimes he's like next to her, and then like next thing you know, he's face to face with her, and then he's next to her again. It felt like a little, some continuity issues, and I couldn't tell if it was intentional or not. Like, yeah. I couldn't tell if they're trying to like play with your perception of reality or not, but anyway. And then they start making out, which is a shocking moment. You know, I think it's not completely unanticipated, because she's been making googly eyes at him all episode, but like they start making out, and then something happens that is like really unclear in the context of the show, but in the post show breakdown, I think it's Miguel Sapochnik that explains that Daemon has impotence, and that is why he cannot complete the act.
Or even like get the act going.
Yes. Fair enough. Thank you, Kim. That was really unclear. Like watching the show, it's like kind of unclear why Daemon decides to abandon her, right? Like why he leaves in the middle of it. People had some great speculations during the Twitter space. Like maybe it's when Rhaenyra was into him and that's why he felt like, oh, I'm no longer in control. Or he himself realized he had guilt around perhaps betting his much younger niece. But it's like, no, it doesn't. Maybe some of that played into the impotence, but it was like the impotence that was primarily the factor. And it's tough to convey impotence if you're not showing anything and there's no dialogue. Just putting it out there, right? So it's like, it's a tough creative brief, but they probably needed a little bit more than what they showed in the episode is kind of my assessment of it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw, to me, I was reading the whole scene, which Miguel Sapochnik, I think, also said in the behind the scenes thing, as like, we're watching a form of abuse unfold, right? Where like Daemon, who... there's a power imbalance here. He's significantly older than her. I think at this point she's supposed to be about 18 and he's in his like early 30s. He's, you know, her family member, an authority figure in her life and all this stuff, but also like by bringing her out of the castle, he really has put her at risk, and he's the best thing that she has for protection. So even if she was uncomfortable at any point, she can't really leave. And then it's like he brings her, he's kind of like opening her eyes to sexual exploration, which, like, great. 18-year-old girls can be sexually explorative as much as they want. Like, she seems really intrigued by what's going on in the pleasure house. He also seems to bring her to, like, a back room that I think is, like, the taboo room, you know? Like, in the front room, we saw other kind of, like, high, what looked like highborn ladies just sort of watching people sexy dancing. It's almost like the front of a strip club. Not that I'm, like, super well-versed with strip clubs. Just saying. But it's like he brought her back to a room where there's, like, guys making out with guys and, like, threesomes and orgies happening. So it's almost like he got her into this space where, like, the most risque things are happening, which, like, therefore, I guess incest is also chill in this back room. Like, no one really seems surprised to see them there. But yeah, when he pulls back, it was like, to me, that was such a, like, an abuser thing to do of, like, oh, as soon as you've gotten comfortable and into this, I'm going to make you feel like you're doing something wrong, or I'm going to withhold my affection from you all of a sudden because, like, reasons, right? Like, he wants to play hot and cold with her.
Right. The way it was staged, where she's trying to kiss him and he kind of pulls back, very much gave me the vibes that you're describing.
Yeah.
But
and then leaving her, that shot, God, my heart broke.
Yeah, he leaves her and she's kind of like in a state of undress, basically. Mm-hmm. And
she's drunk. He's been giving her what I assume is like a stronger liquor than she's used to. Like, when she takes a swig out of his little thing, she kind of coughs. And, like, we've seen her drink wine. She knows what wine tastes like. So I assume that that's something stronger. So he's been, like, plying her with alcohol, getting her a little, like, loose and uncomfortable. And then to leave her in that vulnerable state where she's, like, afraid to the point that she's, like, calling out his name was really awful. And, like, I guess there's no excuse for it. But I don't think impotence is the best narrative reason why that would have happened. Mm-hmm. I thought it was more of a conscious tactic on his behalf.
Yeah, and it's, again, like I said, it's tough because there's no character that says what happened. You know, he's not like, this never happens. Like, he doesn't say anything like that. And so, because they want it to not have any words. Like, it's...
Because it's confusing to her.
Right. There is... But as a result of very little dialogue happening, it does leave the scene really open to interpretation as to how it played out. So,
And to anyone who was watching, which, like, we get this report. It's interesting. Yeah. The little bird who runs off and, like, supposedly...
The little street urchin you know, that he sees everything that's going on. Yeah, it's unclear to what extent he witnessed anything. Right.
He was outside of the whatever. So it's a lot of word of mouth, which again plays right into Fire and Blood, the book, which is supposed to be this, like, very subjective historical account with sometimes conflicting reports of what went on. And so this was just like, I thought it was a really smart way to film this scene and show, like, all of the ways that people might have thought that they knew what happened, but really nobody knows. Only Rhaenyra and Daemon know at the end of the day. And they both fudge their stories.
Mm. Is this sequence of events depicted in the book at all, Kim? Or
yeah, so it's actually, there's like a much more kind of elaborate explanation of stuff between them going on, but it does explicitly say that Daemon returned to King's Landing and that he began spending a lot of time with Rhaenyra. Like, it starts with, like, oh, they were going dragon riding together and eating lunch together and just, like, generally bonding. And then it gets to a point where it says that there are, like, conflicting reports, but one of those reports is that he started taking her to a pleasure house to, like, instruct her on the way of seduction. Mm. And that they, like, did everything but P and V. So, like, her maidenhood is still... is still preserved, but that they were, like, having sexual relations, and that they were, that it was discovered by someone who, like, found them in bed together. They both insisted that nothing happened, but Viserys sent Daemon away anyways, as basically like, he seems to be stirring up some shit in King's Landing and we can't have that.
Interesting. So yeah. It's fascinating that, like, how a show like this needs to compressed time too, right? Because what you're describing takes place over, like, days, weeks, months, whereas this is like one night of action. And I think it's more dramatically impactful that it's one night, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so she goes back to her quarters. Sir Criston's super confused. He's like, what? She didn't leave their quarters.
Right.
And he goes inside to be like, what's going on? And then she kind of is really intent on getting some action tonight. So one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this scene where they basically slowly decide to have sex with each other. And it's really interesting the way that it's filmed, because first of all, it's by far the most joyful of all the three sex scenes that are in the episode, right? Like,
yeah. Or at the very least, like, tender, like, yes. It almost seems sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, there is a power dynamic at play. Like, she is technically his employer, right?
Yeah.
But I think the episode takes great pains to show that he is also a willing participant in this. Like, at any point, he probably could have been like, hey, I'm out of here. Goodbye, I'm out of here. And there's actually this moment where I think he's, like, at the threshold of her room, her bedroom. Mm-hmm. And then he, like, decides to, like, proceed.
Yeah.
And then they start, like, slowly and dressing at the same time, that it does seem like it is consensual. At the same time, there is a power dynamic at play, and those things can coexist and are compatible. So
yeah. I was really uncomfortable when she was having to, like, coerce him into the room and kind of, like, messing with his helmet, and he just goes completely, like, stiff for a while she's, like, taking off his graves, which are his, like, little forearm armor pieces. And, like, she kisses him and he just has, like, no response. And I was like, oh, this is, like, this feels yucky, right? Like,
yeah.
He's sworn to do basically whatever she says. He's her protector, but he also has this, like, sense of honor and duty. And, yeah, you can sort of see the moment. He like, has to take a moment to, like, put down the white cloak, which is, like, the symbol of his virtue and his honor, and set that aside. And then he, like, sweeps her up in a kiss. And I was like, oh, okay, like, he is into this. He was just... he needed a moment to kind of, like, make the decision. And then, yeah, there's, like, a really sweet shot of them, like, both lacing their boots or, like, untying their boots. And they both kind of have the same face of, like, haha, like, this is a little awkward that we have to take our boots off really slowly. But, like, it does add to there's so much time clearly that passes between that kiss and them actually beginning to have sex that, like, he seems to be fully consensual with it at that point. And yeah, I think that it felt important to me that Rhaenyra went from a situation where she thought something really exciting and, like, empowering was happening to her with Daemon, and then was left very, like, humiliated and vulnerable and upset, and then, like, went and decided to, like, take charge of things and take charge of the way that she was going to have her first sexual encounter. And she did it with this man who she clearly very much trusts and who she knows generally has her best interest at heart. And so, yeah.
But at the same time, you know.
But at the same time, it's not as clean as that.
Yeah, using her station, and that's yeah. What I think is great about the show is, like, none of these sexual encounters is quote unquote clean in any way. Like,
totally,
there's always some kind of imbalance in the encounter, and all marriage is political, basically, and in some ways, all sex is political in the show. So
yeah, especially if you're a woman. Because, like, she makes the point over and over again that, like, young men are allowed to do basically whatever they please. But exactly. For her and for Alicent, there's so many layers to it.
It's also striking just how much stuff he has on, like, Sir Criston has on. You know, like,
getting dressed.
She's, like, slowly removing his layers of stuff. And it's like, dude, I bet it's sad that they don't have showers in Westeros, because I bet it's pretty ripe under there. I'm just putting that out there. But yeah, they have, like, tons of stuff that, like, you're just like, wow, like, this must be a huge pain in the ass to put on every day.
Yeah. And he just stands in all that outside of her room, presumably, like, all night.
Yeah. I think it's also, like, a lot of questions around, for me, I'm fearing for Sir Criston's life during this entire encounter, right? And I'm afraid for Sir Criston because, A, if it's ever discovered that this has happened, he's probably going to lose his job in the Kingsguard, right? Because aren't Kingsguard supposed to be celibate? Or
they are, and it's interesting because within what we've seen in Game of Thrones, like, Kingsguard are not general, like, very few of them seem to actually adhere to the rules and customs and practices. Obviously, like Jaime Lannister is a member of the Kingsguard in the opening episode.
He never stepped out of, he towed the line sexually all the time, is my understanding.
definitely didn't do anything wrong. Definitely didn't have sex with his sister all the time and father bastards. And even like Meryn Trant is like Joffrey has his Kingsguard like beat the crap out of Sansa. Like that's not an honorable and virtuous thing to do. So this idea that the White Cloak is supposed to be like this, I think that at this point in House of the Dragon, in this prequel setting, it's still a position that carries a lot of honor and has not been publicly sullied in the way that we see it later is in Game of Thrones. But so yes, he's aware of that fear, you know, like he kind of like looks back to the door a few times to make sure like no one's about to walk in right now. Cause that would definitely create a shitstorm.
Indeed. And also like, what if Rhaenyra gets pregnant? I mean, my interpretation of like where I was guessing it would go would be she gets pregnant and then like has to marry Daemon to like
cover it up
in some way, you know, but I don't think that's what's going to happen based on what happens at the end of this episode. We'll see. So there is a scene with Miss Arya.
Yeah.
She's back, baby. And clearly they've broken up.
Right.
Her and Daemon have broken up. And not only that, but Otto apparently clocked that she was probably not super happy with Daemon in the scene at Dragonstone from a couple episodes ago. And she is now one of his sources. What's her official name in the show now?
So she's like known as the White Worm, but her title, she's Master of Whisperers. So in the same way that Varys was the Master of Whisperers in Game of Thrones, like we don't see her sitting on the small council the way that Varys did occasionally in Game of Thrones, but she's serving that same role where she's presumably
it's an official position, Master of Whispers.
Yeah. Or Doctor. Like at the court. Mm. I don't know if the small council always has a Master of Whispers, but
it's like court jester is like, there's a court jester and there's a court Master of Whispers. Basically.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah.
So she has, we see they call them little birds in Game of Thrones is the name for like the small children basically that she has who spy and then report back. And so she's the one who sent word to Otto that this thing had happened, which again, that little bird wasn't in the room. Like yeah.
That's what makes it so like interesting and kind of confusing is like what we see him see is only that she like Daemon walks past him and then she walks past him. And that's it. That's all we really see this street urchin see. And then she communicates that to the White Worm. And then like, what does she tell Otto? We don't know. Like, does she tell Otto like they were seen together or that they were having sex or whatever? And then does Otto, you know, is Otto passing on information from the White Worm, which again was already would have been inaccurate, or was he kind of upping it himself? Like it's unclear who is actually doing what, unfortunately, as far as I can tell.
And this scene with Miss Arya also kind of absolves Daemon of a tiny bit of scheming here because like he seems surprised to see her and to like find himself in that bed. So it's like, okay, did he really just go and get so drunk that he can't remember anything? Did he not anticipate that anybody would be watching them? But it kind of seems like he did know that. Just a lot of murkiness, which again is right in line with the books of like, it's a bunch of he said, she said, they said, everywhere. So, yeah.
So King Viserys grows a spine this episode. He's actually making some big moves this episode in a way that I was a fan of. Like this is him at his most admirable and effective, and he actually like seems to recognize what is going on around him. Mm-hmm. Because Sir Otto Hightower goes to him in the morning and is like, "Hey, I have some very discomforting news." And this is long and painful conversation. And King Viserys is actually making like reasonable demands. He's like, okay, we'll say what it is. And he's like, do I have to say it? And he's like, yeah, you have to say it. It's pretty freaking important that you say, you know, and it's like, yes, these are important questions. And then, you know, Otto Hightower says they were coupling, you know, and King Viserys gets really upset. And he kind of kills the messenger, you know, which is, I'm not a fan of because like maybe Otto Hightower was giving him information that was good, but what Viserys then says to Rhaenyra later is like, it doesn't matter. You know, she says like, you don't, you didn't hear my version of the story. And he's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what your version of the story is. The perception is already there. Like that's that's all that matters. Like people are out there talking about it like it's true, and that's all that matters. And it's like, damn, that is the first smart thing that King Viserys has said like in the entire show, right?
True.
But he does kind of have this conversation with Rhaenyra, and he shows her the dagger, and it's so important, the Song of Ice and Fire, blah, blah, blah. So what did you make of the dagger and that whole scene and him kind of telling her about her responsibilities?
I mean, I thought it was a little bit hammy. I was like, oh, we're doing like the ring in Lord of the Rings of like, ooh, there's been a secret message on this blade the whole time that only fire can reveal. You know, okay, cool. I guess I did like the added history that like not only was that blade Aegon the Conqueror's, but he mentions Aenys before or Aenar before him. Aenar is the Targaryen leader who there was a child, we've talked about this I think before, named Daenys the Dreamer, who had a prophetic dragon dream that something that the doom of Valyria was going to happen. And Aenar was the one who like believed her and got the Targaryens out of there, which is the reason why they are the last living like direct bloodline of dragon riders, which is pretty cool. So like fun little like lore tidbits, but yeah, I think that they just really want to hammer home that like everything that we're seeing is still connected to eventually Jon Snow and Daenerys. Like the fact that they name drop the prince that was promised, like that's the phrase that came up so often in Game of Thrones and in A Song of Ice and Fire, and bolstered all these fan theories about, okay, who is it? And then in Game of Thrones, we learn that like, oh, that word could have been mistranslated. It could mean princess. And so like the idea is that Jon and Dany combined were able to defeat the White Walkers and unite the Seven Kingdoms or whatever. So yeah, just more little lore, little sprinkles, little lore sprinkles for us in this episode.
I don't know about you, but when my wife and I watch any TV show or film, whenever the title of the thing is spoken, we always do a Ron Howard from Arrested Development thing. And we're like, hey, that's the title of the thing. So they not only dropped A Song of Ice and Fire in this episode, they also dropped House of the Dragon in this episode. I don't know.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
So they're just dropping the name. We're like, that's the title of the show. When Matt Smith says it, it's like, that's the title of the show. Anyway. So he has this conversation with her where he impresses upon her like how challenging the thing is that she's doing is, and they kind of have this like negotiation of, okay, I'm gonna do the thing you say. She actually agrees, I think, to marry Laenor. Is that right? Which I was like stunned by. I'm like, wow, I can't. But she's like, you have to do your duty, which is get Otto Hightower the heck out of there now. Otto Hightower's game is he wants to be close to the throne and close to the axis of power. And I guess by sharing this news with the king, he wants to take Rhaenyra off the board, right? He wants the king to basically be like, oh, it's a bad idea for Rhaenyra to be queen. Now Aegon is going to be king, and Aegon is Otto Hightower's grandson, right?
Yes.
So that would be what he would prefer.
Yeah.
But...
And we see him mention his brother again, Lord Hightower, who we saw in the hunting episode. And Lord Hightower certainly seems to have a massive agenda. Like he seems almost like confident that the Hightower bloodline is going to get on the throne here via Alicent. And so like there are times where I'm like, I can't quite tell if Otto himself really wants this or if he is like acting out of some sort of duty to his family and his brother and like doing his job as the messenger here. But he clearly overstepped and maybe underestimated how much Viserys would be able to see through the fact that there's a reason why this rumor has gotten the legs that it did.
Indeed. Well, we will talk a little bit more about that. But first, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors. We'll be right back and talk about the final scenes in this episode of House of the Dragon. King Viserys realizes what's up, and he calls Otto Hightower into the small council chamber. Love the way this scene is staged, blocked, lit. It's like very dark, sad, brooding, and it starts with them at opposite ends of the table, and then like he slowly kind of approaches him as the scene goes on. It's, you know, not super complicated blocking. It's just like a nice classic, like we start emotionally distant, then there's a big confrontation at the end. I like that. There is he talks about like 5 days as being like very important. He's obviously, King Viserys has written out this whole speech. He wants it to be poetic, right? What did you make of this 5 days conversation? Do you have a sense of what he was trying to convey? And for those who aren't as familiar with the lore, can you articulate it for us?
I mean, I think it was, again, an interesting like retelling of history, right? Because Viserys is essentially recounting all the political machinations that happened around his own father's death, his father, Balon, who died of, quote, a burst belly, which we've talked about before, I think. But it's like that's basically likely appendicitis, just like randomly killed someone. And yeah, like the idea that on paper,
people in Westeros have dragons and they also have vestigial body parts that can get infected, it seems, uh-huh. or explode.
Uh-huh. And pugs.
we're so much more alike than we are different, you know. It's us true. And the Westerosi people is kind it's of true. What I'm thinking. So
it's true. Anyway. But yeah, Viserys kind of like going through this like 5 days timeline, I think, is a good example of how like history on paper can feel one way. Like if you just, you know, order of fact, this person died, so then this other person had to take over their position, whatever. But Viserys is like imbuing it with all of this meaning and intention and like manipulation of being like, oh, you must have been so thrilled that like that happened because it immediately elevated your status in the kingdom. Yeah.
And, but I think it is unclear, right, as you said, to what extent Otto Hightower actually is driven by just blind ambition and to what extent he actually is doing something that he believes is best for the crown and or the kingdom. And also that applies to like what he was doing this episode, you know, like he's clearly making a strategic move by telling the king this information. Is it a good idea? And what was actually told to him? We don't actually know, you know, but the most fascinating part to me is that the information that was told to him was wrong, was like factually incorrect. I mean, they were making out and stuff, you know, Daemon and the princess were making out, but it was factually wrong what was told to him.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out like, does that make it more interesting, less interesting, you know, but it's like, huh, like, he was operating under bad information or he chose to feed the king bad information. But like on some level, it doesn't matter whether the information is good or bad, right? Like he's telling this really upsetting information to try to provoke an action from the king and hopefully not get his ambitions realized or recognized.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately like what ends up sinking him in the end. So
yeah.
They have a big confrontation and he basically fires him as Hand of the King. He like removes the pin, which is really symbolic. Any other thoughts on this big confrontation, Kim?
I just think it's really interesting to watch Viserys and Otto have their little showdown as opposed to what we saw with Rhaenyra and Alicent, because it's basically the same, like the same sides of family confronting each other over this rumor, but it plays out so much more interestingly between Rhaenyra and Alicent because they have a bond that like, as much as I believe that Otto and Viserys have been like good coworkers this whole time or like good boss and manager dynamic, you don't really get the sense that they're like drinking buddies that actually like spend a lot of time together outside of the High Council or outside of the small council meetings. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually, sorry, I flew right over that scene where Alicent and Rhaenyra have the confrontation and she kind of, Rhaenyra, I think, plays it pretty smartly. I think she knows that she only has one option, which is to deny everything. Because if her maidenhood is compromised, like she is going to be in a bad situation. It will be like a big scandal. She might not be heir anymore, right? Is my sense, I guess, right? So she has to deny. And technically what she's saying is true, but it's the spirit of what she's saying is not true because she obviously...
She towed the line up to the point that she then finally said, Daemon never laid a hand on me or like Daemon never touched me. And I was like, well, that's not true.
Yeah.
There were hands. There was touching. And I also like, again, love the tension coming into that scene where like her and Kristen clearly think that they're about to get called out. And then like, I think that Rhaenyra entered that conversation in the Godswood thinking that she was about to have to lie about what happened with Ser Criston, but instead she's like, oh, we're actually even further back in my night of exploits, and I have to come up with a story about Damon. Like, I don't think that she was expecting that. So I do think...
I'm glad they didn't go the full-on sitcom route of her being like...
being
like, them thinking they're talking about different things, and she's like, look, like... You know, I really just wanted to spend time with Sir Kristen. And she's like, what? I wasn't talking about Sir Kristen. You know, like, I'm glad that didn't happen. That would have been
totally,
you know, lame, but.
Totally. And honestly, at parts of their confrontation, I was getting vibes of like, dude came back from his bachelor party and is lying about not touching a stripper. Like, oh, I just went to the brothel. Like, nothing happened. It feels to me like there's still, you know, in earlier episodes, and Millie Alcock and Emily Carey, who play young Rainier and Allison, have talked about like how there are slight romantic undertones to some of their interactions. And this felt like a time to me where like they were having a conversation as like queen and princess about like customs and expectations, and also having a conversation about like almost jealousy and like the way that they are both able to have access to relationships outside of one another or not. Like in Allison's case, she doesn't have anyone right now except Viserys, and we've seen how miserable that kind of makes her. And Rhaenyra feels like she can't have a relationship with Allison in the same way anymore because she's now married to her father. And so like Rhaenyra has been seeking enjoyment elsewhere. And then I think you kind of see her feel badly about that in this conversation with Allison.
Yeah. Basically there's subtext to all the Allison Rhaenyra conversations of like, why can't we be better friends? Why can't we be, you know, closer to each other in any number of ways? And it's because of all this stuff that we're actually talking about on the surface, but deep down there's like other things that are animating all that we're discussing. So
totally.
It's really sad, but I think it is good that Allison tells Rhaenyra so she can kind of prepare herself, right, for this. Allison does right by Rhaenyra in the episode, and that's
totally,
that's nice to see.
And then she really advocates for her in private to Viserys too, being like, look, we all know Damon is a manipulative little liar man. Like, we don't have any evidence that Rhaenyra is also that way. And so, like, really stands up for her in that regard.
I think what I love about the episode is everyone is going out on a limb in a big way in this episode, right? Like, Damon goes out on a limb when he like makes a pass at Rhaenyra, and Rhaenyra is going out on a limb when she kind of like makes a pass at Sir Kristen, and like, you know, both situations, obviously we've already talked about the power dynamic there. And then Otto is going out on a limb by telling the king this information that maybe his life would probably be better if he didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And then Rhaenyra is going out on a limb by denying everything, especially when she already slept with Sir Kristen. And that already is its own mini scandal that hopefully no one's ever going to find out about.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's just like, everyone is kind of like going out in a way that could really damage them. And that really ratcheted up the tension for me watching it. I'm like, what is going to happen if literally any of these deceptions are discovered, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, Otto's ambition is discovered, and that's primarily it. But there is one other big confrontation that happens this episode, which is the one between King Viserys and Damon. Damon's dragged into the courtroom, and they have this big argument about it. And couple of things to note about this scene. First of all, you get to see the throne room from below. Like, you get to see like out of focus what the throne room ceiling/roof looks like. I'm like, man, that looks pretty nice. You don't usually see it from that angle.
True.
Probably because it hasn't been built is my guess. This is like a CG thing. But also, more importantly, from a character perspective, Damon doesn't deny anything, right? Like, and I thought that was an interesting choice because he could have. And if Damon's denying it and Rhaenyra's denying it, then they probably could have convinced the king that it was complete bullshit. Like, I think that would have been a possibility.
Yeah.
But I think Damon realizes that it is more advantageous to him strategically if the king believes that something did happen. That's my guess. What was your assessment of the Damon Viserys confrontation?
Yeah, I mean, it was that when Damon finally says like, well, just wed her to me, I was like, ah, there's the gambit. Like, Daemon might have this whole time known that if he just gets Rhaenyra in enough of a vulnerable and like public position with him and sexual relations or handsy relations, that it might besmirch her virtue to the point that the only way to preserve that and to maintain Targaryen rule would be to just marry them and be like, oh no, this is, we always do this. Not we always, we sometimes do this. It's fine. Just marry her to me. The thing that I don't believe that it was like straight up a play for the Iron Throne. I think that Viserys just like, or that Daemon can't not push Viserys's buttons. And it was like, as soon as he got back, did the nice ceremony of like getting back in the king's good graces, he was just onto the next scheme of how to like disrupt Viserys's life and get his attention and sort of like establish himself as like a chaotic, dominant person in King's Landing. But it backfired this time, probably because he was so hungover that he couldn't even like summon a lot of words, which I was like, that's real. When Viserys like kicked him right in, I think like the kidney. And I was like, oh, like if you've been drinking for like 24 hours and you just get like a kick to the kidney.
I wouldn't know personally, Kim, but you know.
You know what? I've never been to a strip club. I've never drank for 24 hours straight.
Yeah, you know, it's the respectable part of the strip club. Up front is what I imagine it would be.
That's where all the drinking happens.
Yeah. So he suggests like they marry and that they like bring the full strength. He says the words House of the Dragon at some point, right? I don't remember.
Yeah,
the
like
exact
the full
line.
Strength of the
full
House
strength
of the
House of the Dragon, you know, yeah, like to its former glory, bring the House of the Dragon to, you know, something along those lines. So, yeah. And I think you're right that he didn't try to seduce Rhaenyra with the intention of some kind of Iron Throne aim or anything like that. But I think that in the moment, and maybe you're right that it's just like he's just less pushing the buttons and like he had nothing strategic in mind there, but I do think it is kind of like to his advantage if Viserys believes that he and Rhaenyra have been intimate, like
I think it benefits
Daemon if that's the case. So he's like, I'm not gonna deny it because it doesn't make any sense to do that. So anyway, that's what I would do if I was an incestuous treacherous, you know,
uncle to a princess.
Murderous psychopath. Yeah. I mean, you know, not that I am. I'm just imagining in the same way that Kim knows what strip clubs are like. That's what I imagine what a person in that situation would be like. So mm-hmm. Final sequence. There is the question of, hey, did Rhaenyra get pregnant when she slept with Ser Criston? And I was curious, like, is that going to become a plot line? Well, nope. They're going to nip that situation in the bud. A Grand Maester brings her this drink, and he's like, I prepared it myself. Now, there is a name for this drink, this beverage in Westeros, right, Kim?
Yeah, it's known as moon tea, sometimes tansy tea also, but like moon tea is the most common phrase for it. And yeah, it's pretty widely known, especially among people in like who like the sex workers basically have to drink it all the time, so they're not just constantly getting pregnant, because I guess as far as we know, condoms, no one's invented like a sheepskin condom. We have pugs in Westeros, but no one's taken
we
the
have
time
pugs
to-
and we have plan B, but we have no condoms.
Yeah,
if you're keeping track of reproductive medicine in Westeros,
and dog breed advances,
dog breed advances. The two things that I know everyone is tracking listening to this podcast. So
exactly. Yeah. Moon tea does work. It actually seems to be like a combination of plan B and an actual abortion pill, because plan B in our world doesn't, terminate a pregnancy. It prevents a pregnancy from ever happening if you take it within a certain amount of time after having unprotected sex. Moon tea like does both. Like it will both prevent a pregnancy from happening, or if you're in the early stages of a pregnancy, it will induce an abortion basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, the fact that the Grand Maester brings it and says that it's from the king, I was like, okay, if we take that at face value, Viserys is basically like, there's a phrase for it. It's like he's insuring his ducks or something. I don't know.
Getting all your ducks in a row?
I guess. Or shoring up his...
There's a duck-related saying you're reaching for. Is that what's happening?
Whatever. Saying doesn't matter.
Getting all your ducks in a row. Chickens coming home to roost. Circling the wagons.
All of the above. I don't know. It's like his insurance policy, just mm-hmm. in case Rhaenyra was actually lying to him.
And you're sure the idiom has to do with ducks?
No, I'm not. We'll just we can move on.
No, it's okay. Let's explore this. Here are popular duck idioms. Okay, like water off a duck's back, to be a dead duck. To have one ducks in a row, to take something like a duck to water, to pour water on a duck's back, to be happy as a duck, duck and cover.
Duck and cover.
No, it's none of those? Duck
no.
face? None of those? Okay, sorry.
No, I'm well. Sorry. I'll think of it and then tweet it later or something.
Yeah.
Whatever. Point
you're
is...
You're going to get like 50 tweets with whatever it is.
Excellent.
You're
Please yes. give me all the duck-related and non-duck-related idioms that might encapsulate the idea that it's like his insurance policy of like, mm-hmm. just in case she was lying to me, I'm going to have the maester bring her this moon tea. But I don't entirely trust Grand Maesters within Westeros. A lot of the Grand Maesters...
They haven't always been reliable? Is that what you're
no.
saying?
Like Pycelle in Game of Thrones was like notorious for just like swapping allegiances or like mm-hmm. promising one thing to one person. He also, like the Maesters also seem to have access to sort of like a little bit of a spy network depending on their position. So like, I don't entirely trust that this definitely came from the king. So then it's like, okay, who else could it have come from? Maybe Alicent, again, also if like she maybe was still doubting what Rhaenyra had told her, but that seems kind of unlikely. I was also like, is there any chance that Criston Cole himself like got an audience with the Grand Maester or something?
I don't think that happened.
I don't know. Or maybe, I don't know. Maybe it was just Viserys and we're just supposed to believe that he doesn't, that it's a sign that he doesn't fully trust mm-hmm. Rhaenyra even at the end of all of their airing of grievances.
That is the Occam's razor, but I agree it could be any number of things. It could have been Alicent would be the other strong contender for it. I do think the episode ends in an interesting way where she's looking at it and then it cuts before you see whether she drinks it or not. So I guess we're going to find out if she drank it or not, hopefully on next week's episode of the show. So, all right. I think that is the episode. Any other thoughts, Kim Renfro, on this week's episode of the show?
Really just, again, how much I really loved it. We also didn't really talk very much about the fact that Claire Kilner directed this episode. First woman directed episode of House of the Dragon so far. And I think that it showed that we saw and understood all the nuances and all the power dynamics that were happening between these younger women and the various men in their lives. And I just really appreciated the approach that they took to what could have been a like disastrous sequence of
yes.
Sexual relations happening. I thought that they really nailed it.
Yeah, and certainly I think Game of Thrones, you know, in its day had some issues with this depiction of how consensual things were and so on. And I think that was way less of an issue with this episode. Like you really understood what the dynamics were. So. Okay, Kim Renfro, until next week, can you let people know where they can find more of your work and any articles you want to point them to?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Kim R. Renfro, and then all of my articles go up on insider.com. The Insider Entertainment team is where you'll find my little detail breakdowns, interview snippets, all that jazz.
In addition to Kim's work, one resource I consider essential to understanding House of the Dragon and TV in general is Miles McNutt's Episodic Medium newsletter. It's an awesome newsletter. I read it all the time. And they're having a 20% off deal right now. Check it out at episodicmedium.substack.com. If you like written versions, written reviews of the episodes, written recaps, then episodicmedium.substack.com is a great place to get those. And of course, if you want to support this podcast, very easy to do that. All you got to do is go to decodingtv.com and become a paid member. You get access to ad-free episodes, exclusive bonus episodes. Find more episodes of the show at castofkings.com. Find us on YouTube and TikTok at youtube.com/castofkings, tiktok.com/@acastofkings. We'll see you next week for another episode of A Cast of Kings, recapping and reviewing House of the Dragon.
Goodbye.